Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Intercepted.
Welcome to Intercepted. I'm Murtaza Hossein. This week, the United States announced its recognition of a new government in Pakistan, led by a coalition of parties opposed to former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The recognition comes on the heels of a brazenly fraudulent election this February that saw massive voter suppression, rigging, and outright violence targeted at Khan supporters. Despite that crackdown, and despite Khan's ongoing imprisonment on politically motivated corruption charges, his party still garnered more votes than any other party. The result of this election has further bled away legitimacy from the military-run Pakistani regime and its civilian clients, who are now relying on Washington to give them the legitimacy that they seem to lack domestically. Joining to discuss today is my colleague Ryan Grimm, host of Deconstructed, who's also reported on Pakistan with me over the past year. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
So, Ryan, you've been a staple at State Department briefings in D.C. talking about Pakistan, both before the election and since then. Can you give us a little glimpse of what the U.S. official response has been to this election, which has struck many people around the world and Pakistan beyond as maybe one of the most rigged and the most unfair and unfree elections Pakistan's had, certainly in recent history?
Not just Pakistan. It's probably, at least over the last, say, 30 years or so, the kind of most obviously rigged election in a country where you expect some basic level of democracy. Now, obviously, Pakistan has had a flawed and challenging time. The democracy movement there has, you know, has serious adversaries internally in Pakistan. What I mean by the fact that you might expect it to be democratic is, say, to compare it to something like Saddam Hussein or Bashar al-Assad. Like, when Saddam Hussein wins, like, 98% or 100% to zero, nobody says, "I'm so shocked," because, you know, Saddam Hussein has, such strong democratic bona fides that I can't believe he would, undermine democracy like that. But in a country where you have contested elections and you have an election commission that is supposed to be taken seriously, there probably hasn't been, that I can think of, I'm curious for your take, an election that was so flagrantly and almost comically rigged. I don't want to say that it's funny, because this is a country of more than 200 million people who were watching their democracy get flushed down the drain. But the way they're doing it is just wild. Actually, I'll give you one example that I just saw circulating today. On one of the forms that the Election Commission just uploaded, on the original form, the PTI candidate, or the independent candidate, he's independent because he wasn't allowed to run as PTI, got 584 votes in this one precinct. When they uploaded the form, you can see that somebody took a pen and drew a circle around the five and turned the five into a zero, kind of with a little slash through it, which then leaves you with the number 084. But then when you look at it, you're like, that looks like a kid just turned a five into a zero. And they did that kind of all across the country. Can you think of a comparison in another country like that is expected to have reasonably transparent elections that flipped it this flagrantly?
No, you know, it's a really, really good point you're making, is because that, you know, Pakistan has had very, very serious challenges with military rule and dictatorship and threats to democracy for pretty much its entire history. But it's always had, you know, nascent democratic institutions. It's never been like a one-man state run by Bashar Assad or Saddam Hussein, something like that. So people have expectation that they can say a lot of things that they want to say. And then if they vote, maybe there will be some manipulation, but it'll still be, you know, an election which is somehow worth voting in, you could say. Not like a 95% or 99% for one guy type situation. But I think it's because Pakistan is a very, first of all, it inherited democratic institutions at its outset. It had like the setup ready for a democracy, and people tend to take that seriously. But also, you know, it's a very big country. It's 250 million people by some estimates, definitely well over 200 million. It's very hard to control that number of people in a way you would like a smaller dictatorship of 20 million people, maybe say Syria was at some point. So it's a very unruly society in a way, in a good way, in the sense that they had a very boisterous press, very boisterous civil society. And I think this is the first time that I certainly have ever seen, and I'm talking to people there pretty regularly who I've known for years, seen the level of suppression and fear and you know, that type of fear, that type of military-controlled fear of a whole society that's ever existed before. And this election was really fascinating because, you know, I think that they did so much before the vote to suppress the PTI, including, as you alluded to, banning the party from actually contesting and forcing the candidates to contest as independents, putting Imran Khan in jail, trying to humiliate him in various different ways and ruin his reputation. Despite all that rigging and all that pre-election sort of manipulation, which was, you know, far in excess of what we've seen anything in Pakistan, I'd say ever, you know, the PTI still did really well. PTI-affiliated candidates actually trounced the opposition. And I think this is significant of something which has been kind of building up in Pakistan for a long time, is that if you follow the politics of the country, the military is always the hand behind the throne, you could say. But in the front, on the throne, there seems to be this rotating set of families, like the Bhutto family or the Sharif family. And it's almost become like a monarchical in a way that, you know, these few groups of families think that the country belongs to them and they extract huge financial benefits from the situation. And meanwhile, the military, it keeps its own prerogatives. The military controls so much of the economy. And this situation, which has become so intolerable, is reaching the point where it can only really be enforced by a dictatorship now. And so you're seeing Pakistan, which, you know, as you said very well, it's had like, you know, some reasonable democratic institutions, despite all suppression. It's moving towards more like a situation where you're going to have to govern it like Saddam Hussein or Bashar Assad did their countries. And I think that would be very, very dangerous and very, very violent, because how can you control that many people using that much violence without kind of cracking society up? So I think that that's coming. And to your point, I can't think of a single country that has had, you know, elections which were rigged in such a strange and a bizarre way with the expectation they should have been real elections. Because I saw the videos and some of the footage that you mentioned. I also saw videos of people, like, you know, running up to polling stations and dumping all the votes in the back of a truck, like almost comical, cartoonish levels of manipulation. And it also struck me that the Pakistani military has been caught kind of flat-footed by the digital age, which is really unacceptable in 2024. Because I think that this type of rigging, everyone has a cell phone camera in Pakistan now, or most people do, or more than ever people do, you're going to get caught if you do that. And you get caught by that type of brazen sort of behavior. And also, you know, our reporting has kind of caught them flat-footed too, because as much as they've tried to stop Pakistan's traditional media, they cannot silence the entire planet and the entire planet's media, which is the situation they're facing at the moment. So that's really interesting. And I want to ask you, you know, just, you kind of mentioned it a little bit too, but, you know, you're at the State Department on a regular basis, and Pakistan comes up quite a bit, and you're bringing it up, and other people are bringing it up. What is the role of the U.S. in the situation, and why is the U.S. opinion of what's going on in Pakistan so important to the situation itself, but also to elites in Pakistan, evidently?
I feel like some of it is almost psychological, that there's some kind of post-colonial relationship that the Pakistani elite, the Pakistani military in particular, has with the United States, where there's a real hunger for approval. Because the amount of money flowing from the U.S. to Pakistan is not comparable, say, to Israel or Saudi Arabia or some of our other, you know, nations where you might expect to get that kind of reaction. So some of it just feels almost like a part of the post-colonial culture. On the other hand, Pakistan is, to a significant degree, an aid state that is running an extraction-based economy, which means that, you know, it constantly needs, you know, fresh infusions of global capital. Like, you know, China's a major investor as well. You know, the IMF plays a huge role in their politics. The IMF played a big role in the last government, the ouster of Imran Khan, and the upcoming kind of reassessment of the next tranche of the IMF loan is going to play a huge role in in Pakistani politics, and hanging over that is the specter of the United States, because, you know, we can, you know, pull a lot of strings over at the IMF. Leading up to the election, the response that you would get from the State Department was effectively a green light for rampant electoral fraud and rigging. And it doesn't sound like it. You have to be able to parse the language that you're hearing, but that's what diplomats are very good at. So what you would often hear from the State Department whenever I or other reporters there would confront them with the most recent allegation of massive rigging. Things like not letting candidates file for office, or a candidate comes to file to run for office and they abduct him at the office, or he files for office, goes home and his home is raided and he's thrown in prison. We're not talking like ticky-tack electoral violations here. We're talking about, you know, major suppression, or like literally banning the party from running, things like that. You would hear from the podium, we encourage Pakistan, like all countries, to hold free and fair elections, and we look forward to those elections being free and fair. You know, just very kind of generic statements. And you might say, okay, well, that's wonderful. You know, United States standing up for free and fair elections, good for them. Anytime a country that was in a more adversarial posture vis-a-vis the United States had any type of irregularities going on, you could see what the United States is capable of. And that's anywhere from sanctions to much harsher language. Belarus had an election recently, practically before the polls were closed. State Department was out with a statement that says, you know, we condemn the sham elections in Belarus. Iran, when it cut the internet in, you know, during some protests, State Department put out a, you know, livid statement talking about the way that it was suppressing this, it was suppressing, you know, people's, you know, freedom of assembly and ability to communicate with each other. When Pakistan shut down the internet during its own election, you get a very muted statement. Then in response to the obvious shenanigans that were going on in Pakistan, you'd start to get words from the State Department like, you know, they're concerned about the irregularities. But you compare that to what you were hearing from a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill, they were saying there should be no recognition of a, you know, future government that comes out of this sham process without an independent election investigation. State Department never went that far. And my understanding is that that was read, you know, by the Pakistani government as essentially a green light that, okay, United States is expressing some embarrassment basically about, you know, how ridiculously the Pakistani establishment has rigged this election, but they're not going to stand in our way from forming an anti-Imran Khan coalition, even though it was quite clear on election day that Imran Khan's coalition, his party, won an overwhelming majority of the votes.
You know, it's fascinating that there's been such a brazen, as you kind of described it, steal, and the U.S. has kind of been a handmaiden to that. Very quiet, you know, before the election, and certainly quiet and accepting of the outcome since then. It's very interesting, the statement, I think you pointed out on Twitter or X, the statement that the U.S. put out about Shehbaz Sharif, the new prime minister, accepting powers, that we congratulate him on assuming power. They didn't actually say, per se, that congratulate you on winning the election.
Yeah, I have it here. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
So the U.S. embassy in Islamabad posts, and all of everything in diplomacy matters. Like, does it come from Blinken? Does it come from Biden? Does it come from somebody lower in the State Department? Does it come from the ambassador's, you know, personal Twitter account? Does it come from a different account? Everything is parsed. And so this one comes from the Twitter account of the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. So it's kind of the lowest level of a Twitter account that you could choose to kind of send out a message. They say DB, which is the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. That's all he signs it at the end, DB. He says, I extended my congratulations to Shehbaz Sharif today on his assumption of office as Prime Minister of Pakistan. I look forward to working closely with the government and people of Pakistan on our mutual interests. To me, you can read two things from that. One is that they really felt the pressure from the Pakistani diaspora here in the United States and from the global outcry not to full-throatedly endorse this brazen theft. But also that there was really nothing that the diaspora or any other entity could do that was going to stand in the way of the U.S. moving forward and recognizing this coalition, which is, you know, the one that it wanted to take power. But they did it in the in the weakest way possible. I congratulate him on his assumption of office. And Matt Miller over at the State Department described it as a selection, which is kind of funny because, you know, you often hear like radicals in the street chanting, you know, selection, not election, selection, not election. And then you've got the State Department spokesperson referring to the election as a selection, yet still recognizing it. So it has the power. Now, what power it has in this fractured country remains to be seen. It might be a little bit of a poison chalice that they've taken to their lips here.
You know, it's so funny because I'm sure that most Americans are not even aware that this happened or that the U.S. government's played this role in Pakistan. But I'm talking to people in Pakistan these days, and they're very upset. They're very upset, you know, of obviously the double standards and hypocrisy. And also, you know, despite all the missteps of the U.S., people still sort of look to it as the only kind of power outside which can, you know, validate or give their approval to a democratic outcome. And it's so clear that there was not any democratic outcome or democratic process in Pakistan at all. And yet for the U.S. to weigh in and to give this sort of thumbs up to it, however weak and however sort of caveated it was, it's been very alienating to people. And it's kind of a consistent theme of foreign policy, in my view, that, you know, Pakistanis are noticing very much that the U.S. took this position, but Americans are not aware of it because they have other things going on and they're not focused on, you know, XYZ issue in South Asia. But, you know, those negative sentiments in Pakistan are going to exist now towards the U.S. because of the actions of some State Department officials who deemed it, you know, in their interest to recognize an election that they knew was not real. I was kind of curious from your perspective. Obviously, you know, Pakistan was very important to the U.S. During the Cold War, during the War on Terror, and the U.S. war in Afghanistan played a role that the U.S. needed to rely upon. But now today, I don't really see a lot of strategic utility of Pakistan to the U.S. And the military in Pakistan has always looked to find ways to make itself relevant to the U.S. And it's really struggling. It has a story we did a few months ago about the arms sales to Ukraine, but it's kind of more peripheral activity. I'm kind of curious from your perspective, why did the State Department, or in your view, why do you think the State Department may have felt the need to, you know, weigh in and kind of give this sort of reward to something that I think they knew was not a real election? Was there a strategic benefit, or was it more like an inertia that they just don't care about Pakistan enough, so they'll recognize whoever's in power there? Or is there more like a settling scores with Imran Khan situation that may be undercurrent of it?
I mean, I think you can never kind of underestimate the power of score settling and inertia combined. Like, I think that might end up having a significant amount of explanatory power. But beyond that, it is a really interesting question because the U.S. is going to take heat. It's expending its most valuable capital, which is its ability to talk about, you know, freedom and democracy, by championing this election. Like, it's really embarrassing for the U.S. to allow this to happen, because now anytime they talk about the sham election in Belarus or the sham election in Iran or the sham election in Bolivia or Venezuela or wherever they want to go next and complain about democracy not being respected by, you know, XYZ adversary, they can easily point back and say, look at this clown show that you supported and operated in Pakistan. Like, don't tell us that you care about democracy. So they're willing to take a really powerful hit to stand behind this absurdity, which then raises your very good question of why. Like, there must be some compelling U.S. interest that they see on the other side of this debacle that makes it worth taking this hit. And what is that? We have, like you said, the inertia and the score settling against Khan. But to me, it indicates that there is more going on when it comes to kind of U.S. jockeying vis-a-vis India and China than we even understand. That's my guess, is that there must be some play that the U.S. sees here in Pakistan that relates both to its interest in kind of buttressing India and raising India up as a bulwark against China, and also some concern that China and Pakistan, which have, you know, deep historical ties and financial ties together, that if they get too close together, that somehow that undermines whatever strategic interests the U.S. has in that region. It's hard for me to get my head around exactly, you know, what it is that they think they're doing. They may not know entirely what it is, but that's my guess, that it has something to do with their interest in basically cozying up to this rising power of India and guiding it in a way that allows it to be some type of a tool that it can wield against China in its endless kind of competition in this newish coldish war with China. What's your guess? Like, what, because there has to be some compelling interest on the other side of this that would justify or make it worth it for the U.S. to torch so much of its democratic credibility.
You know, I think a consistent theme throughout Pakistani history or Pakistani-U.S. relations is that the U.S. government seems to prefer dealing with the Pakistani military. And I think you see it in other countries too. They historically prefer dealing with the Turkish military. It's a lot easier to have a single point of contact as opposed to dealing with a big society, which is, you know, messy, different opinions and different factions. It's just a lot more convenient. And from a military to military perspective, the Pakistani military is a very, you know, relatively functional institution. It has capacity to, you know, produce ordinances and do things that are useful to the U.S. There is a strategic benefit that they can draw upon. It's also, you know, Pakistan's a very poor country, but it has like the sixth largest military in the world, something that very, very high sort of ranking in terms of disproportionate spending on military matters, which is not great for Pakistanis. And it's resulted in a very, you could say, underfed society in terms of institutions and economic growth and so forth. But the military is very, very powerful. The intelligence services are very powerful. They're currently undergoing a very extensive military modernization at the moment. So the money that's not being invested in, you know, sanitation, healthcare, and, you know, basic education, things like that, it's really going into making the military such that it can stay on par with its, you know, regional rivals and sees itself as being needing to stay on par with the top level of military modernization in the world. So from a U.S. perspective, you know, I can see why they like dealing with the Pakistani military, because it's just very convenient for them. And they don't want to have to deal with Pakistani society, because Pakistani society will produce someone like Imran Khan, who is very, as you know, it was put in a very famous cipher we wrote about, aggressively neutral about things that the U.S. cares about a lot, like the Ukraine war, which most Pakistanis just don't want to be involved in because they don't see it has anything to do with them. So, you know, when you have a situation where, you know, you can have a country where you have to deal with occasional pushback and occasional sort of resistance to U.S. prerogatives, or you can have a very dependent, very strategically, you know, overgrown sort of institution that represents the whole country, that is willing to do what you say and willing to take a more of a junior role and defer to U.S. prerogatives, I think that the U.S. will choose that. And I think it's sort of a problem with many post-colonial countries, because, you know, in a lot of colonies, and especially in the British and French colonized world, the military was the most built-up institution because that's what they needed to rule. And then when the colonizers left, the military was still there, and all these other parliaments and so forth were much, much more nascent and underdeveloped in comparison. So that's why they had military domination. And then military domination of local politics ended up being an extension of, you know, neo-colonial control because, well, we have these close military relationships. A lot of Pakistani military officers traditionally got trained in Britain or the U.S., so they developed these very deep, lasting relations. They developed a culture which was familiar to, you know, many U.S. elites. And, you know, they kept that relationship going. And then if you look at some countries which broke the mold, and, you know, I was very critical of things happening in Turkey, but, you know, the one accomplishment of the Turkish government is breaking the control of the military over society. It's civilian control now. Pakistan has never reached that level. And I think that from an American perspective, while for Pakistan it's not great, for them it's kind of good because, you know, if you want to buy arms from Ukraine, Imran Khan won't do it. The military will. And it is doing that.
I think it points to this interesting phenomenon in U.S. diplomacy, which is sort of like laziness or arrogance. And last week on Deconstructed, we talked with the author of a new book on Lumumba and, you know, post-colonial Congo. And in that situation, you had some interesting overlaps in the sense that Lumumba, you could describe him as aggressively neutral, just the same way that you could that the State Department described Imran Khan, with a little bit of diplomatic elbow grease. The United States easily could have worked with Lumumba. Lumumba had an American and a Western orientation that was kind of fundamental to him. You know, we even talked about how he tried to sell all of the Congo's minerals to an American and kind of con artist for like $2 billion. Like he really was not the kind of Soviet sleeper cell that the U.S. pretended he was. on the one hand, you can say, well, it's the United States is naive. They're paranoid and they just saw, you know, communists everywhere. And they hear Imran Khan give an angry speech and their paranoia makes them think that Imran Khan is a stooge of Putin or a stooge of China, just like Lumumba was a stooge of the Soviets. But to your broader point, they'd rather have somebody that is a slam dunk than somebody who is, you know, has some neutrality to him that would force them to actually kind of negotiate, you know, country to country in order to kind of create positive relations between those two countries. It's much simpler from a diplomatic perspective to just say, you know what, I'm not so sure about Lumumba. He might be oriented towards us. He might be oriented toward the Soviets, or he might actually just be a you know, Congolese nationalist. Let's just get somebody in who we don't even have to wonder about. And I think the Pakistani military is somebody that the U.S. just doesn't have to worry about. It's just easier to deal with from their perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You know, in the U.S., despite the State Department's recognition of the Pakistani government, there has been some buildup of pressure over this subject. I think a lot of it driven by the Pakistani diaspora, which is concentrated in certain areas and sometimes is quite economically or politically influential locally. So you see some members of Congress sort of bringing up pressure on the U.S. government to question more what happened during the election and also the circumstances of the entire removal of Imran Khan and what happened after and potential U.S. involvement. Can you talk a bit about what you're seeing and hearing? I know we had a story recently about this too, talking about a recent letter from Congress about the subject. What are we seeing in terms of internal domestic political division in the U.S., which may at some point bring pressure to bear on the Pakistani government to come clean about what's going on there at the moment?
Right, and the Pakistani diaspora has been incredibly successful, heavily concentrated in the medical field, and particularly within that, heavily concentrated in the world of kind of physicians and doctors, well-educated, well-organized bloc here, but not huge. I don't have the numbers in my fingertips. I don't know if you know what it is, but, you know, less than 2 million, maybe even less than a million, you know, Pakistanis in the country. But like you said, concentrated in areas like Houston, Northern Virginia, Washington State. And so, you know, for instance, Abigail Spanberger, CIA analyst turned member of Congress who is now running for governor of Virginia, has been outspoken in support of Pakistani democracy. And that's I think, particularly because of, you know, local pressure and local organized pressure from people that, you know, she would like to see support her as she moves up the ranks in Virginia. Greg Kassar, kind of a squad adjacent or squad member who represents Austin and San Antonio, has been quite outspoken as well. There's a, you know, significant Pakistani population in Texas. Kassar was one of the leaders of this letter that circulated that said, you know, the State Department ought not to recognize any Pakistani coalition government until there's been an independent investigation. You know, that only wound up with fewer than three dozen members of Congress signing it. That is at once a significant number that can't be ignored, while also being, you know, far fewer than you would need on letters like that for the State Department to be genuinely intimidated by it.
You know, Ryan, so for the past year, me and you have been sort of very much in the weeds about Pakistan, more than we ever probably expected to be, you know, based on
yes,
what's going on there at the moment. But yeah, it's interesting for our listeners who, you know, are coming to it more freshly. Last year, me and Ryan reported on a secret document leaked from somewhere in the Pakistani military intelligence complex about showing the way that the U.S. had put pressure on its Pakistani counterparts to remove then Prime Minister Imran Khan from power. It's known as a cipher, and Imran Khan himself, before he went to jail, had been talking about it quite regularly. And subsequent to that, we did some stories about post-Imran Khan U.S.-Pakistan relations in terms of the way that the military had switched from Khan's status of neutrality in the war in Ukraine to becoming an active supplier of arms brokered by the U.S. to the Ukrainian military. And also, you know, some other irregularities and some other problems with the current charges that Khan is facing, which could have very serious consequences for him at the moment. Some serious problems in terms of how those charges actually are substantiated and so forth. You know, we've had these stories, and I think that they're indicative of very severe divisions inside Pakistan and very great unhappiness with what's going on in there at the moment from all sectors of society, you know, not just the general public, but also institutionally and so forth as well. Because obviously Pakistan, under its current leadership, is trying to replicate itself in some sense as a dictatorship, because the once very vocal Pakistani press has been more or less silenced. That's why this reporting is now being done by people like me and you in the U.S. who have more latitude and we're kind of free from that sort of suppression. But also, you know, the whole pretense of democracy is going out the window in the sense that we have like this parody of democracy instead. And, you know, far more so a parody than it was maybe any time in history. And, you know, it's interesting because it's very scary in a way, because if you put so much pressure on society on all fronts, it can really kind of blow. And now we're seeing Pakistan evolve in that direction. You know, I'm curious, like, what you think it's indicative of in terms of, you know, if the U.S. continues co-signing it, how it may blow back on America based on past experiences in other countries, but also, you know, what the threats and dangers are of Pakistan heading to a situation where it could become very unstable. It's a nuclear armed country of, you know, well over 200 million people. You know, if you were telling U.S. policymakers why it's not a good idea to keep co-signing this, what would you indicate to them as some of the major dangers?
I might say, I really hope you know what you're doing here, because you're playing an extraordinarily dangerous game with, you know, people's hopes and dreams here. You know, if you go back to Imran Khan's removal back in early 2022, that's followed by extraordinary levels of repression against his movement. You know, effectively, the complete and total disbandment of his party, the jailing of most of the leaders of the party. And in a typical scenario, an autocrat or powerful authorities may expect that that had solved the problem. Like, levels of repression that extreme in other historical contexts and other countries have been able to effectively smother, you know, whatever movement there was that it represented. That it failed so spectacularly is something that I think the United States needs to take into consideration. We described the levels of election rigging that went into this before, you know, February 8th. The authorities clearly believed that they had done enough to basically destroy the support for Imran Khan and the PTI. Otherwise, they would not have allowed the election commission and the precincts to begin reporting results on election day, and they wouldn't have allowed the broadcasters to broadcast those results to the entire country. And we know that because once it was clear that it had been a landslide victory for Imran Khan supporters, they barred the election commission from continuing to report numbers, and they barred the broadcasters from continuing to speak, and they shut the internet down. But because they had left open that window, you know, on election day, the entire country watched the returns come in and watched Imran Khan's party, you know, picking up a majority of seats in the government. They then had to steal it from under that, you know, very clear victory that had been presented. So the fact that they put that many obstacles in front of people, you know, there were stories of 40% of the population is, you know, illiterate, and they took away the symbol of the party, and then on election day moved people's polling locations all over the place and shut down mobile service. So people couldn't kind of text each other. People couldn't do what they normally did on election day, is text a particular number and find out know, where they're supposed to vote. We heard stories of a family in one household would have multiple different precincts that they'd be supposed to vote in, depending on who in that family was voting, and they would be miles and miles and miles apart, so, you know, sometimes tens of miles apart, like extreme long distances, that people were willing to walk over, you know, all of that glass to go to vote in an election that most of them believed would actually be stolen from them. That's the thing. They weren't naive. They didn't go out thinking that it was going to be a free and fair election. They went out assuming it was going to be robbed, yet they went out anyway. So now that they are suppressing that mandate and instead putting in this other government, raises the question for the United States, okay, now what? How sure are you that this isn't going to blow? Like, how much do you think you can take this, you know, steam and keep it in the kettle? At some point, this thing is going to blow. Elections are the way that people let out their steam. And by getting some directional representation, like you said, they don't expect that they're going to be, you know, completely clean and fair elections. But you might expect that if it's an absolute landslide victory, that at least they're allowed some level of something close to representing that. If they're not, what is left for people to kind of express their democratic impulses other than violence, other than the kind of complete disintegration of the institutions that are stitching the country together? So to me, they're really playing with fire here, which goes back to the question of why, like to what end? What is on the other side of this for you that makes it worth this extraordinary nuclear-fueled gamble?
It's very easy to succumb to cynicism. And, you know, obviously the U.S. government seems to become very cynical about the subject. But you're right. Pakistanis did so much to vote in this election. It's kind of touching, actually, the way that people went so out of the way to register. Yeah, what they felt was their, you know, vote about their future and their kids' future and so forth. And despite the knowledge that they knew no one's going to respect it, they just wanted to make sure that people heard. And to turn away from that and to reject it so forthrightly, it's very disillusioning. So it's something that I think I've noticed and you've noticed and we all have. One thing I wanted to ask you, this whole reporting on Pakistan, for me, and I'm curious about your perspective, is very eye-opening in many ways, because I think we saw a lot, not just about Pakistan, but about the U.S. in the situation and the U.S. media as well, too. Because, you know, The Intercept reported on the Cipher document and many other classified documents, and we reported on the Pakistani election. I think we're one of the few outlets which bothered to report on this. It's one of the most important, it's one of the fifth biggest country in the world by population, had a fraudulent election, had the deposal of a very popular prime minister with U.S. involvement. You know, I think other outlets, they either could not report on it for technical reasons, in the sense it's very difficult to do some of the reporting we did for security and other purposes. But also, it seems like they were just averse to doing it. And, you know, there's a reason why the reporting came to The Intercept, because we were capable, but also we had an interest. And it made me think that if people in Pakistan can't rely on their own media now, because for very obvious reasons, the military is crushing the media there and made it very dangerous. Reporters have been killed, they've been abducted. So it's a situation like that there. But in the U.S., where, you know, we are free and we are very involved in the situation, there's been incuriosity, complicity, I would say, also with what's going on. You know, you're going up there to the State Department every week and, you know, yelling at the State Department, Vedant and Mark Miller and so forth. Where's the rest of the people? Where's the rest of the U.S. press who, you know, they know very, very well that their own government is involved in co-signing this very unjust situation, but they're absent. I'm curious about your own perspective, but this is very strange to me in a way, but, you know, how is it that The Intercept has become maybe the last bastion of free speech for Pakistanis and even for Americans' involvement of knowing what's going on with their country in this other country?
Maybe if some of these media outlets recognize that there is a really active diaspora that is hungry for this coverage, you know, that could help in the future to get them a little bit more interested in doing some of this coverage. There's the obvious old saw that, you know, U.S. readers generally are not given much to read about when it comes to, you know, American foreign affairs, either because they've been, you know, trained not to care about it or they just don't care about it either way. So, you know, I think editors look at Pakistan as just not remotely interesting. I was actually talking to you know, a top editor at one of the major papers, you know, who edits and who helps guide coverage, you know, in this area. And what she explained to me was, look, you know, for a couple of years it was Ukraine, now it's Israel, Palestine, it's Gaza, and if it doesn't fit directly into that, then there really isn't any appetite among editors at the top papers to cover it. There are all sorts of, you know, interesting intersections, you know, between the story of Pakistan and Ukraine. You know, we covered the entire affair, you know, the entire deposal, coming from, you know, Pakistan's unwillingness to be, you know, 100% supportive of the Ukraine war effort and trying to stay neutral, and then later secretly making weapons for Ukraine. But, you know, as she said, that's kind of complicated. That's not a quick daily piece we can do. And when it comes to Gaza, you know, one of the most popular, if not the most popular, Muslim elected official in the world is Imran Khan. And to not have his voice at this moment, I think changes the way that, at minimum, kind of the Muslim world is able to respond to what's going on. It's hard to say what the effect would be of having him in office, in power, at this moment. I'd be curious for your take on that. But those are not close enough tie-ins from the perspective of these major media outlets for it to kind of warrant any attention.
Yeah, it's disappointing because then we don't cover these subjects, or the media doesn't cover these subjects. And then when something happens later on, they're very surprised, but with the context where no one really has the information as what led to it. And yeah, I do think if Imran Khan was free at the moment and was able to speak, he'd be very voluble at what's going on, because he was never one to censor himself or to hold back about his opinions about affairs well beyond Pakistan's border, which I guess was what annoyed the U.S. State Department and U.S. officials so much about him, and led to his the predicament he's in now.
Annoyed some of the Arab states as well. They would rather prefer to not think about, for instance, Kashmir, or not to think about the Palestinian question. Palestinians were getting in the way of the Abraham Accords, and Imran Khan would embarrass them in front of their own populations by refusing to kind of just go along with these kind of two, in some ways, interestingly related impulses from the West to say, look, okay, we're not going to solve these problems. Let's just ignore them, you know, pre-October 7th. Let's just pretend they're not happening. And Imran Khan was unwilling to do that.
Ryan, thanks again for joining us in this crossover episode. It's like Flintstones meets Simpsons, those cartoons when you're a kid. I love those episodes, so it's like that one again.
Which one is which?
I think you're Flintstones. I think you're Flintstones, and then I'm Homer.
Sounds good. That sounds perfect.
That was The Intercept's Ryan Grimm, DC bureau chief and host of Deconstructed. And that does it for this episode of Intercepted. Intercepted is a production of The Intercept. This episode was produced by Laura Flynn. Rick Kwan mixed our show. Legal review by David Brelo and Elizabeth Sanchez. And this episode was transcribed by Leonardo Fireman. Our theme music, as always, was composed by DJ Spooky. If you want to support our work, you can go to theintercept.com/join. Your donation, no matter what the size, makes a real difference. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Intercepted. And definitely do leave us a rating and review whenever you find our podcast. It helps other listeners to find us as well. And do check out Deconstructed as well. If you want to give us additional feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Murtaza Hussain.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.